CU Progressive News. Yes, hello. Hi, I'm Sandra Otten. You are listening to WEFT, WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. The views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, station management, the board of directors, or the WEFT associates. No, they do not. They represent those of myself, Sandra Otten, and Saxon Burns, who's in the studio with me tonight. Hello, Saxon.
Hello.
He is a new air shifter here at WEFT, so I gave him the hard job of trying to figure out our phone lines. We've got Representative Carol Ammons on the line with us tonight shortly. We're working the details out for that. I'm going to crank up my levels a little bit. There we go. That's better, I think. That's not even... I need to bring my mic up closer. All right, we've got all this worked out. Well, we have some news for you tonight, as well as working on having this interview with Representative Ammons. And I wanted to just start out with some news about a county executive referendum that's coming up. For some reason, I'm getting a lot of echo.
I'm going to try that
without that mic. That's better, isn't it? Yes. Okay. All right. This week, the Champaign County Chamber of Commerce announced a coalition with the Champaign County Farm Bureau to create a citizens' initiative to change the way county government is structured. Currently, the Champaign County Board elects its chairman by the county board members, not by the people of Champaign County. The Chamber and the Farm Bureau state that they want to put this election in the hands of the people of Champaign County. By electing to move to a county executive form of government, they believe the people of Champaign County will have a voice on who the leader of the county is. This is in contrast to the current form of government in which the county board elects from among the members of the county board, almost always ensuring that the chairperson is a member of the majority party. The county will not be changing the terms of employment of the county administrator, a paid administrator, who's Rick Snyder, who just came on in March with a contract of a base salary of $127,500 through the end of this year and a base salary of $130,000 for the following 2 years. So we've got somebody administering the county who makes $130,000 a year. This elected position would be a paid position in addition to that county administrator. Currently, the board chair is paid a stipend. I'm not sure what that is, but I know the total amount that the board is paid, including for the board chair, is less than $30,000. So every member of the county board gets a stipend, as does the county board chair. But this position that they're talking about creating, that is the elected executive, is not a determined amount, but a member of the Champaign County Farm Bureau says that elected county executives generally are paid in the high $90,000 range. The executive powers would be much stronger than those of the existing county board or the county administrator. The executive would have the authority to set meeting agendas, propose the county budget, make appointments, implement the majority of county ordinances, and most important, veto actions of the county board, although votes could be overridden with a 3/5 majority. The executive would also have the power to vote, but only to break a tie. The only other Illinois county with a similar position is Will County, which got an elected an administrator in 1988. A similar referendum here has failed 4 times in Champaign County in the past. It has been an effort that was endorsed by Laurel Pressing, the mayor of Urbana, when she was county auditor. All right, we're going to try this one more time. See what we can do here, if we can get things in the right order. Hi, Carol.
Hello.
Oh, good. Yay. I was just telling the listeners about our proposed change at the county executive referendum. You used to be on the county board yourself.
Yes, I was listening to that.
Mm-hmm. Just finish that story and say that if you have information and informed opinion about this issue, you can email me, weft90.1@gmail.com, so that we can be aware of both sides of the issue as we follow the story in the months leading up to the election. The 500 signatures to make it a referendum on the ballot are being collected at the Champaign County Chamber of Commerce. I don't have an opinion on whether it would be a good thing or not. I think that I think the people in the rural areas are probably hoping for it because they feel like they might be underrepresented. Maybe that's true, maybe not. I don't know. Do you have an opinion on
it,
Carol?
Look at the policies, and that'll tell you who's being represented.
Look at the policies?
Yes.
With regard to the executive?
The policies that come out of the county board largely reflect the rural area, the highways, bridges, the farming area, largely. The only internal parts of that process is usually the county courthouse, the county administrative building, the nursing home, those things considered, if you want to consider it in within the city limits. But a lot of the policies are certainly rural in their intent.
Well, we will follow that closely and get your opinion on it. Tonight we want to talk to you about your role as state representative because we have budget on our mind, as everybody in the state of Illinois does. And as I was preparing for the show, I had some people who told me that they wanted the top question to be why you're not in legislative session. I bet you get asked that a lot. You want to start with that?
Oh, sure, sure. Technically, we are in legislative session. We have session tomorrow. We are in what's called continuous session right now. We don't have everyday session unless we have legislation to vote on. Otherwise, we'll just be wasting taxpayer money going back to Springfield with no actual legislation to vote on. On tomorrow, which is Wednesday, no, on Wednesday, not tomorrow, tomorrow's Tuesday, on Wednesday, we'll be taking up a couple of pieces of legislation that have come out of the working groups, and I'm sure we'll talk about that at some point during this conversation as to the actions that the legislator would take up.
Okay. So lay out the scenario for us. We know that the way that it's characterized in the media is that you guys are having a squabble. The Democrats and the Republicans just can't sit down in the same room together and iron this out, which is what people think that needs to happen. And tell us why that is not necessarily the case, that it's just a matter of being able to sit down in the same room until it works out. Has that been tried?
We can sit down in the same room. The problem is largely centered around the issues for which we are gulfs apart on. And some of those issues, certainly in our district, higher education being one of them, these are huge divides between the Democrats and the Republicans. So it's not as simple as, you know, B's and R's sitting in the room saying, hey, I like this, do you like that, or vice versa. It really centers around how we will fund higher ed, for instance, and will we make available MAP grants and other scholarship funding for students to attend the university?
Right.
Or, you know, how we would deal with transportation. The governor wanted to cut one of our Amtrak trains, and we say, no, we need that Amtrak train for the students that's going to reach an additional, you know, 70,000 students that attend the University of Illinois. You know, how do we make sure that we are protecting the public interest, the regular folk? That's where the gulf comes in. We could talk about some of the other issues that are driving the wedge between the Democrats and the Republicans based on the governor's legislation that he just put out.
That he just put out when, Carol?
So there's a bill that's been filed. It was filed technically on May 31st at about 8 p.m. So just before we are going to, quote-unquote, in session, the spring session, the governor filed a bill. That bill included K through 12, higher ed, human services, agency operations, general services, capital plan, court spending. And in that particular bill, for instance, K through 12, the Democrats put forth a bill that would have additional money in K through 12 available to the tune of about maybe $700 million. And the Republicans put a bill that was far less than that to a tune of about $200 million. Now, when you get into the K-12 funding discussion, you're talking about a formula that is attempting to get state revenue dollars or GSA dollars to those poor communities like us downstate to make sure that there's some equity in funding. But the governor's proposal basically freezes that and what he considers allow funding across the board, which means that wealthier districts, they benefit greatly, where poor districts don't.
Is that just pretty much with regard to the K through 12, where that inequity lies?
Oh, well, in this case, K through 12 is a big part of the discussion, and the equity grant, which is what is that helps to try to bring some balance to public school funding.
Mm-hmm.
That equity grant is what's at the heart of this discussion, and there's some concerns on the side of the Democrats when it comes to equity in funding for education. And so those are not easy. Let's just sit in the room and hash it out. When one side of the aisle wants to reduce the amount of funding that's available for low-income communities like ours or children in poverty, and others want to provide funding for people who have a considerable amount of resources available to them.
So the K through 12 issue is one of the primary issues, but this has been an issue ongoing of how to fund K through 12 education in Illinois for a long time. It's not equitable, and it's funded. K through 12 education is funded primarily through through property taxes,
property tax.
And of course, richer areas have more property tax to use for their schools. So, from what I understand, sometimes they have like $30,000 per child is being spent on.
That's correct.
And what would be another typical? Do you have any idea how much we get per child?
I think ours is just about maybe close to $14,000 when you add in your equity grant.
Okay, explain the equity grant to us then. So it's
considerably lower.
How does the equity grant work?
Now that's a little more complicated and above my pay grade.
Okay. But in general, money comes from the state of Illinois to make it more equitable. So they're supposed to get try to bring the funding levels more closely aligned from the state budget.
Yes, and it's a formula, and the formula takes in consideration several matrices that they are measuring as to who gets what amount in that general state aid formula. So it's a very kind of complicated formula. But what we do know is, as you described, some northern communities like Winnetka, very, very wealthy communities, under the governor's proposal, they will gain a considerable amount of money for their district. And some of the other districts will certainly lose money, and they won't gain to the same degree that brings equity in the formula. And so that's an ongoing battle. And, you know, it's been going on a very, very long time. Our goal under Senator Menard's bill was to try to redo the formula so that the resources to get to those schools who are much more in need. And that's been the part of the battle.
Okay, I have Saxon Burns in the studio with me. He's. I'm asking him if he has questions for you.
I didn't hear.
Right. Who's in the studio?
He's a new air shifter who's working the board for me tonight. So you can
say, oh,
okay. Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah.
Hello,
good. Hello. Good. We'll see if he just wanted to invite you into the conversation if you have anything at all, Saxon, through the conversation. But I have plenty to ask you, so we'll just keep going.
Okay.
All right. So. The way I understand it, I do want to get to higher education. I know just the thought of MAP grants not being available at all is just atrocious. I mean, to think that the state of Illinois can't provide the basic, I can't remember what MAP stands for, but basically it's going to be $3,000 per year per student who qualifies due to income to help pay for tuition and books, basically. I used it when I went to school. Almost everybody who isn't going to school with, you know, a huge pocketbook does need it. I mean, it's how you get, it's part of your funding. That's part of how you get higher education. And it certainly would leave a lot of people out of getting a degree. It would have left me out of getting a degree for sure. And so we want to get to that idea of higher education's part of what he's wanting to cut. But I want to get to start with the bigger picture, too. So we have K through 12 in higher education. We know we have issues that aren't even really related to the budget, but that are his his anti-union measures that he wants to enact. And I guess the bigger picture that I just want to just talk about is how does he come to the table? How do we talk, you know, how is there any conversation with regard to this? I guess the piecemeal is what people need to understand, right? That he, in order to make it that there's not any budget, he says, okay, we're going to give this money to fund K through 12. That happened last year so that at least the kids can go to school. And then he does a partial funding of higher education, correct?
He did.
Right. And what
he did a stopgap measure.
A stopgap measure. And I guess what the fear is, even with regard to the MAP grants and things like that, is once they're gone, they probably won't come back. It's that, you know, it's chipping away at the basic fabric of our safety nets in our society. And he's wanting to chip away at them a little bit more and a little bit more. And it just keeps getting more atrocious as opposed to less, while at the same time he's doing these stopgap measures to at least, I don't know even what to say about the stopgap measures. What do you say about them?
Well, you know, so there is just a couple things. There is a working group that is put together to look at the non-budget related issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just kind of go over that just a little bit. So, Rahler demands the turnaround agenda when he came in. So what he said is, in order for us to get a budget, now people have to get this. At no time in the history of Illinois was there these non-budgetary issues tied to getting the only real responsibility of legislators, which is passing a budget. There had never been a time where a governor said, I'm not going to give you a budget if you don't do these non-budgetary issues for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so he came in and said, no, I want this turnaround agenda in order to get a budget. So there's two main things that his working group is working on. One of them is workers' compensation, and the other is collective bargaining. As you mentioned, part of his agenda is similar to Governor Walker's agenda, which was to get rid of these unions. All of our problems are here because of these unions.
You're referencing Wisconsin.
That's Wisconsin's governor.
Mm-hmm.
Took that same role. And so Rana is also going after prevailing wages so local municipalities can drive down the cost of labor, which he considers is a great problem in the state of Illinois. So it really directly affects working families. He also wants to freeze parking.
Well, let's explain what prevailing wage is. It means that instead of having to pay when a governmental agency contracts to build the courthouse or something like that, they need to pay prevailing mm-hmm. wage, which means that they need to pay basically a living wage or a union wage as
yes.
opposed to
yes.
paying a minimum wage.
Correct.
Yeah. So if a government agency is bidding on something, you say you can't hire people at minimum wage. You have to at least be paying them a decent living.
He would like to.
That's part
have
of the
ability to drive down the wages,
mm-hmm.
which is a huge sticking point, again, as to we can sit in a room with the Republicans and they're very great people, but we can't come to terms with them when it comes to driving down wages for people, increasing their health care, which is another issue that he has on the table.
Increasing whose health care cost?
For public workers.
Okay.
So that would include, you know, all of our folks at the University of Illinois, any public worker throughout the state would have to experience either a double or tripling of their health care premium cost.
Mm-hmm. Increase.
Remember that your wages won't go up, but the cost of your health insurance will either double or triple depending on whether you have a single plan or a family plan.
And, you know, a lot of people think that those people at the university, they're sitting in a cushy job over there. But I happen to know a janitorial worker, a secretarial worker, they often have to work, I think, like 3 years before they get their wage increase above like $10 an hour. So it's not like people are making high union wages right off the bat in every sector
sure.
over there.
No.
I think that that's a misconception.
I think what the wages of the university are competitive to, they're a Big Ten university. They are competitive with their counterparts across the state and other Big Ten. And so our professors, our staff, our food service workers, you know, we're trying to raise the cost, living of those who are at the lower end of the wage sector. And under his proposal, that would actually drive everybody's wages down.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a really, this is a huge sticking point that I think the listeners need to really understand. And we can talk about that a little bit further, but that particular one around collective bargaining, the right to organize and bargain collectively for your wages, has been fought for. Many people have died for this very right.
Literally.
And for that to be literally mm-hmm. to be on the table makes it very difficult for us to come to terms if the governor chooses to literally hold hostage everything else if we don't agree. The
right.
twisting of the arm kind of policy.
Right.
If you don't change this the way I want it to, you're not getting a budget.
Right.
And the budget is about the entire state. It's not about just a single issue. And so that's why these issues are compounding the problem, because our choices are either, you know, basically sell out the middle class and working class folks and give him what he wants, or you get no budget.
We're listening to Carol Ammons, Representative Carol Ammons. I'm Sandra Auten. This is CU Progressive News for the 27th of June, 2016. Happy to have Carol here. Thank you, Carol, for joining us, and thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Wanted to let you know, we kind of got off to a rough start with the show, but I wanted to let the listeners know that this show airs every Monday on WEFT at 6 p.m. to 7, and also on Thursday nights on UPTV, and you can catch it as early as Tuesday on UPTV6 on the YouTube channel, so lots of ways to get it, as well as WEFT podcast. We're happy to be exploring progressive issues with progressive folks and bringing you the news about all kinds of issues in the local area. Carol is also an air shifter here at WEFT, and you can hear her on Saturday mornings. Every other Saturday, her or Aaron takes the hot seat. And they alternate with Eunice Buckner Boone for a show called Higher Ground, which they've done for many years, and it brings to light African-American issues in the news and other progressive issues as well. So, Carol, thanks for all the work that you have done in the community, and thanks for the work that you're doing as a state representative. I want to tell people when they want to know about, you know, whether or not why you're not in legislative session, just as an example, some things that people probably don't know is that you're basically, you haven't been paid for a while, I believe, and there's certainly, you haven't been paid. That's right. It's part of the budget. So, and they haven't been paid. Like, there are stipends that they're supposed to get for their apartment in Springfield and stuff like that, I believe, haven't gone through. So there's a lot, it's not like you're, you know, living the easy life while you're trying to get these things settled either. I know that you're working hard for us every day, and I appreciate that. I wanted to let you know.
Well, thank you very much. It's a difficult role, but I remember, you know, my mother always said, well, just do what you like to do. Even if they didn't pay you, what would that be? And this is it. So
Yeah.
I like to do it, and, you know, I'm sure it'll all work out in the end. But
well, I hope so. But
for right now.
In the meantime, I mean, it'll all work out in the end, but at what cost to people's real lives? You know, there are homeless teens. There are men who are, I see them in the morning. It's happening already, you know, that the Time Center has closed down, and as the MAP grants don't come through, there's going to be less people applying for college. There's going to be less, it's hurting real people's real lives. I want to get back to the turnaround agenda. There it was, the prevailing wage issue, collective bargaining. He's really trying to drive down wages and make us a right-to-work state, which is the worst euphemism in the world. But talk to us about the workman's comp. I know that's part of his turnaround agenda that he's holding us hostage with.
Yeah, so Illinois passed major workers' comp reform measures in 2011. And by the governor's own 2014 annual report by the Workers' Compensation Commission, those reforms are actually driving the cost down. And this was an interesting report. Between 2011 and 2015, insurers, the insurance companies, reported a decrease of 19% in total benefit payments. The Workers' Compensation Research Institute found that Illinois was experiencing the largest decrease in the average medical payment per claim among the studied states, and Illinois was experiencing the greatest savings. Interestingly, as a result of the savings, though, those savings the insurance companies saw didn't translate into cheaper premiums for the employers. They literally kept the money.
Who's they?
The insurance companies.
Mm-hmm.
There was a 19% decrease in total payment benefits, mm-hmm. and there was a great savings that was reported in this report in Illinois 2014 annual report, the money did not get turned around in cheaper premiums to the employers of the state of Illinois. So the insurance companies literally simply kept the money from the savings. And so what Governor Romney is saying now is workers' compensation costs are too high. They are. What we really need to do is to hold accountable the insurance companies who have taken literally the savings and kept it as profit for themselves.
Hmm. That's interesting. All right, so we have the workers' compensation, prevailing wage, collective bargaining. What else is in the turnaround agenda? Anything else?
Let me just say that if people want to see this workers' compensation report so that they can kind of get a better idea of what was reported, it's the 2014 annual report by the Workers' Compensation Commission. You can just type that into Google. The 2014 annual report by the Workers' Compensation Commission. And the report says the reforms that were passed in 2011 have had positive results for workers' compensation, but the savings were not benefited by the employers. And so it's a longer report, but that is the overall summary of the workers' compensation fight. We can't utilize these kind of tactics that the governor's using.
Well, let me ask you a different question, Carol. What if we said we're going to give him his turnaround agenda? What do you think would happen with the budget? Would he fully, how could we balance, you know, what would happen then? I don't want that to happen. I'm just saying, like, there are two different issues. Somebody's going to have to give. Let's say he gives or we give. Right. So,
sure.
And I think the people do need to know that's what they would be asking of the Democrats. But let's say that we make it clear to Ronner, those are not the budget issues. Let's say somehow, you know, the state of Illinois, people of Illinois can say, negotiate those separately. Let's talk about the budget. Then how far apart are we?
We've tried to, the latter point that you just made, we've been trying that for the last almost 12 months.
To say it's separate
to
issue.
Say, yeah. Listen, we will take up several of your issues you've put on the table. Let's talk about them in the proper context and form through our committees, through public hearings, through the process of legislative.
Yes.
No one has said that, you know, we won't pick that up. As a matter of fact, we voted on his property tax bill, I want to say 19 times. In the House.
What are you referring to when you call the property tax bill?
Yeah, so the property tax freeze that he wants to implement as part of his turnaround agenda was put into bill form, carried by Representative John Bradley, and we've had it on the floor at least 19 times, and it's not passed at all because people don't want to hurt their communities with the kind of property tax freeze that he's asking for.
Mm-hmm.
So that should not be tied to the income outgoing expenses of the state. It really needs to be dealt with as how much expense do we have, what do we need to do to address the real issues of the state,
mm-hmm.
and how much revenue do we need to run our budget and run our state so that we don't hurt the most vulnerable people like Medicaid and seniors and children.
Carol, how can we find out, how do we know who is getting paid? Because some people are getting paid. The money is, and where's the money sitting at?
Yeah.
That's, you know, so like I run a business and they owe me a lot of money, let me just say. they owe me enough to buy a small house. And but I know that that's because Health Alliance isn't paying their bill, and Health Alliance is a state, it's a employer-funded healthcare plan. And sure. The employer is the state of Illinois, so they're not paying it. But Health Alliance is another option for people who have health insurance, and they must be getting their premiums because they're paying their claims. Do you think that that's accurate? Who is getting paid? How is it people who are suing that are getting paid? Who's getting paid?
Yeah. So there are some consent orders that are being paid. So in fiscal year 2016, there was $32.4 billion available expected in revenue. 90% of the state spending is being done regardless of the budget state right now. So that means 2016, we spent $6.5 billion on K-12. The governor signed that bill.
Say that. So let's start that again. So what? Sure. How much did get paid?
90% of the state spending is being done, regardless of the budget status, 90%.
Really?
Yes. And that's happening because we have court orders, meaning you have to pay a certain amount of Medicaid expenditures for the state that's backed by the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
You have certain things that are in the court, and by the order of the consent decree, or what's called the Liggett consent decree, they have to be paid.
Mm-hmm.
So we did the Liggett consent decree, which is sending billions of dollars out of the state, I mean out of the general revenue fund. We also did K-12, which was $6.5 billion. $11.4 billion of that is mandated payments, like state debt, pension payments, other funds that are required to be paid by law.
So the treasurer writes the checks. Who does she take her?
The comptroller.
The comptroller, thank you. And who does she, it's a she, I believe, correct?
Yeah.
Who does she take her, who does she take her orders from about who she writes checks to?
Well, she would say she doesn't take orders. She's an elected, statewide elected, she would appoint.
Right, but she wouldn't if she had a budget, then she would be doing it according to a budget.
But I understand your point, I think she's responsive to the governor's administration at this point.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying 90% of the state spending is being done. The things that are court ordered, the things that are stopgap measures.
Mm-hmm.
The money isn't just sitting there. It is actually being spent, and it's just being done in a way that isn't according to a budget. It's according to what has been ordered. What about with regard to matching federal grants? Is that being considered, do you know, in what they are paying?
So we do have some matching federal grants that we've done in the last 11 months that required us to match a certain amount of money for programs that are federally protected.
Mm-hmm. Medicaid so being one, I guess, that
yes,
would be an example.
That's the biggest. That is the largest.
Mm-hmm.
We have some with the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. So we have some other departments that we have to do, like Department of Corrections has a few. So they're throughout the state departments, but they are being funded. We have $10 billion in court orders and administrative spending for health care and human services that we must do. We have
What human services are you doing?
$10 billion in court ordered and administrative spending for health care and human services. So those things that have been taken to court that you have to do, that is still being allocated currently. We also have state employees, because obviously government hasn't shut down, even though we don't have a budget. The state employees are still working, and they also have to be compensated and paid, and their insurance has to be paid as well, even though we don't have a budget. And so that is also being allocated, too. So we know at this point we're probably spending, and I know we are, but we can't really tell the way Comptroller Munger's website is set up. We can't get an absolute accurate count or number for how much money has gone out of that $32 billion that we started with.
I know you probably...
But we spent more than that, that's for sure.
You probably can't answer this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So, for instance, I think the state of Illinois owes WEFT $4,000. I think they owe us for fiscal year 15, Illinois State Art Council budget. I think so. And we could use it. And we could use it for next year, too. Will we ever get it?
You know, so I'll go back to some of the sticking points. Let me go back to the sticking point of the governor's proposal. Some of the things that he wants to do is something called loan forgiveness. Now, if you remember closing out fiscal year 15, the last quarter of 2015, there were contracts that needed to be paid, i.e. grants that needed to be fulfilled, like West Grant. The governor decided to sweep some funds, and he selected the things that he would pay. Some of those grants went unpaid in fiscal year 15. And if you remember the conversation around something called the Good Friday cut, some of our grant recipients in our community were part of that Good Friday cut. So some mental health providers, as you know, some grants went unpaid that you're outstanding at your agency, as well as WEF, Prairie Center, several other places were not made whole in 15. The governor has no intention on paying any of that back money.
Well, there goes my vacation.
He's asking for what's called loan forgiveness
in his
stopgap proposal.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not.
Wow. That's shocking. So, how I had perceived it was, well, eventually we'll get the money. Like, if we can write it out, we'll get the money. And that would be not true. That's what you're telling me.
As of right now, the request is for loan forgiveness.
He's requesting, Ronner's proposing that.
Yes.
You can tell I'm a little agog over that one.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
So these are really big issues, but the process of trying to get to an agreement, everyone wants one.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody, Democrat or Republican, wants to be where we are right now. We do know that this was a created crisis, that the governor decided that he would hold the budget hostage for all of these things, and the only thing he would sign would be K-12.
Right.
That is how this actually happened. Even if, and I say if with a big IF, even if he disagreed, and he does, with the Democratic proposal of our spending plan in 16 or even 17, even if he disagrees with that, the governor has the authority and the ability to line item reduce any budget that's sent to his desk.
Okay, so I'm just going to try to wrap it up. I want to make sure we hit on this point. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that you have a majority of Democrats in the Senate and the House, but in the House, you do not have a supermajority. Is that correct?
In the House, we have 71 members, which is a supermajority, but we do have 3 members that traditionally don't vote for a budget.
Okay. And so the goal then in the November election is to make sure that those 3 are out and real Democrats, I guess I want to say, are in, someone who will vote with the supermajority to get this. Because with a supermajority that is voting, there is a possibility that in November we could override whatever Ronner wants and instead go with what a supermajority votes on, because the Senate is already able to do that. Am I correct in that?
The Senate also has a supermajority that has been really working on this, and they've done a great job really pushing back on some of these proposals. 2 areas that are important to this discussion. Yes, of course, the elections are coming up, and that's, of course, the governor's betting. He's waging just billions of dollars on getting people that will turn back the hands on collective bargaining and labor unions and drive down wages and increase health insurance. That's what he hopes to happen. We certainly want to elect progressives that will, you know, stand in the gap and make sure that we have, we protect the most vulnerable in the state. That's a long way off right
yeah,
now.
Yeah.
What we'd like to see, though, is a proposal, i.e. for higher ed, that doesn't cut the university by nearly 60%. That's what we want to see. We want a proposal that would prevent the University of Illinois from laying off people come August 31st.
Well, I get that. I get that we have these things that you need to make do with in the meantime, but our best long-term solution is that idea of getting the November election turnaround for a January, then we could, by January, they'll be in house and you should have your bills ready to go by then.
that is definitely part of the plan that would need to take place in order for us to truly to bring resolution to this.
Yeah.
It's an important part of it. And I hope people understand, you know, when the governor announced that he was going to run again for governor, it really should have sent shockwaves through the whole entire state, because the state is truly in this position, regardless to what the media says or he says, it's the speaker's fault. We would not be in a budget impasse if he had followed the procedures to passing law.
Right.
All of us have to do it. I put forward
So what you're saying, and we need to wrap up, is that he is trying to get laws passed by holding the budget referendum or budget hostage. And the things that he wants are actual legal things that should be put through legislation with you
process.
Be able to vote on. Exactly. Thank you, Carol, for joining
That's
me
right.
today. I appreciate it. It's a lot to grapple with, and I hope you'll be back as a guest in the future, and we will be tuning into your radio show as well to keep informed about what's going on. Thank you.
Well, I really appreciate the invite, and thank you so much, and have a great rest of your evening.
Thank you, Carol.
Okay, bye-bye.
Speaking of the rest of the evening, I've got a WEFT board meeting to go to tonight. WEFT Board of Directors meets once per month, and it's tonight. So if anybody is game to join me there, it's at 7 p.m. at 44 East Main Street at the Lincoln Building. And tonight we're going to be talking about our budget, believe it or not. I'm the treasurer, so I've got a lot to talk about. All right, Saxon, are we ready for this?
I think so.
All right, hold on just a minute. Let me get my thing here. Jean Vandeport, a 66-year-old resident, a card-carrying Urbana resident, a card-carrying professional revolutionary, and a University of Illinois political science alumni who spent his entire career working for labor unions on local and national levels, died on Saturday at his family home in Vermilion County. His longtime associate, Belden Fields, wrote an essay in his honor, which is going to be read now by Saxon.
It is difficult to write about an untimely death of a person one has known for almost half a century. Gene was my student, my comrade, and my friend since the late 1960s. Only a couple of years after my arrival to teach political science at the University of Illinois in 1965, a young, bright-eyed, highly intelligent, and articulate student showed up in one of my classes. It was Gene. He was living in the Danville Collective and driving in to take his classes. The Collective was a group of politically radical young people who were living together at a time when such communes existed all over the country. Gene was a very committed democratic socialist, a socialist in the mold of Gene Debs. He and I shared that ideology. While Gene was radical in his politics, he stood out as being more culturally conservative than many of his radical peers in both his dress and his aversion to drugs. Gene was very interested in the idea and practice of worker control over the workplace. So, one day, he came to me and proposed an independent study course in which he would go to Yugoslavia and observe and interview people who were actually working in factories workers controlled. This made Yugoslavia unique among the communist countries of Eastern Europe. I thought this was very gutsy for someone of his age who had never been out of the country before. I agreed to it, and it turned out to be a wonderful, broadening experience for Gene. It reinforced his conviction that workers did not just need to be objects in a factory production line, as portrayed in Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times. Instead, they had the knowledge, experience, and commitment to run their own enterprises. He became a proponent of both producer and consumer cooperatives that are not uncommon today. Gene was one of those great student protesters of the 1960s. He opposed the war in Vietnam and the treatment accorded to Cuba by the U.S. government. But he was never just negative. He always envisioned and fought for a democratic socialist future in the States. After graduating from the U of I, Gene took a job at the Veterans Administration Hospital in his native Danville. Though he became active in the union and rose to its leadership, there he became active in the union and rose to its leadership. He was so successful in that role that he was called to the Washington office of the union and sent all over the country as an organizer. Anyone who knows anything about unions knows that the job of a traveling organizer takes an enormous toll on a person's mind and body. So, after a number of years doing that, Gene looked for a position that involved less travel, but also permitted him to live in a community in which one could develop roots. He looked back home. He took a position as the director of the Illinois Education Association in this area. This permitted him to be close to his widowed mother, who lived in a house in the woods near Danville. They called it the Green Cocoon. While back here, Gene, along with others, including myself, created the group Socialist Forum. Gene and I also served as coordinators of the Living Wage Association of Champaign, which was successful in getting living wage policies adopted in the city of Urbana and Champaign County. Gene was active in the labor coalition at the U of I. We, and Gene's wonderful wife, Germaine Light, were also very active in the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice Coalition. We engaged in many strike and lockout support actions together. Gene was arrested in a sit-in supporting the Staley, now Tate and Lyle, workers in Decatur. That arrest became a badge of honor for him. Gene and I were very close. He used to call me Dad. And since I had no other sons, he became kind of a son to me. He would always listen to what I had to say, and sometimes he would do what I suggested. But Gene was his own agent, a cooperative comrade in fights for social justice. The labor movement lost a staunch fighter for workers' rights. I have lost a son, a student, comrade, and friend over a span of 50 years. Gene, his wife Germaine, my wife Jane, and I liked to go to the Gene Debs dinners in Terre Haute. Debs was hero to us, a democratic socialist who had to run for the American presidency from a jail cell because of his opposition to U.S. entry into the First World War. Nevertheless, Debs got almost 1 million votes. I am so glad that Gene Vanderport lived to see Bernie Sanders gain so many backers as an avowed socialist. We never thought we would see the day that this would happen, that the idea of socialism would no longer be taboo in American politics. So, my son, one more thing that I advise you to do. Tell Gene Debs all about it up there. Tell him how so many young people supported this socialist. Make his day an eternity. Love, peace, and justice be with you. Till we meet again, Belden.
That was read by Saxon Burns for Belden Fields. When reporter Melissa Murley interviewed Gene in 2014, he said his favorite books were Peace, Power, and Love, Power, and Justice, and The Courage to Be, both by Paul Tillich. His best piece of advice, he quotes his favorite philosopher, Antonio Gramsci, which was pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. And then he added, go do some good. Our sympathy is extended to his wife, Germaine, and to the rest of his family. All right, now we have some events to tell you about. There's an unveiling of a new mural that's happening on Friday, the 1st of July at 11:30 at the IMC. They announced the official unveiling of the new mural that was commissioned by the Board of Directors. A party with the Urbana artist Maya Bauer will be held outside on the south side of the IMC where the mural is located, which is in between the north side of Lincoln Square and the downtown post office. UC IMC board commissioned Maya to create this mural, and they want you to come and join them for the celebration. It's a kid-friendly event. Activities for children include a bouncy house. So lots of fun there. Okay. That is on the 1st at 11:30 to 12:30.
You're going to have to help me with that word.
Pachacacha.
Pachacacha.
There you go.
I have a lot of problems with that.
You're going to get it.
Volume 21 of this exuberant showcase for local creativity guarantees insightful thinking, quick takes on a broad range of topics, unbridled enthusiasm, and ideas to spur your imagination. Pachacacha night includes 8 to 14 unique presentations on a topic of the presenter's choice, In each presentation, 20 slides are shown for 20 seconds, each with an explanation by the presenter. While Pachacacha nights happen around the globe, the local event was started and is hosted by CUDO, the Champaign-Urbana Design Organization. Artists and presenters are to be announced. Remember, adult language and topics are always a possibility. That's happening on July 30th from 8 to 10 p.m. at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, 500 South Goodwin Avenue in Urbana.
A little closer to our date here, July 8th, there's going to be a concert at Research Park with La Cafeterias and Bone Jugs. At 6:30, local favorites Bone Jugs gets the evening simmering with an eclectic mix of acoustic jams fueled by an uncommon symphony of xylophone, kazoo, resonator guitar, upright bass, percussions, horns, and of course, bones and jugs. At 7:30 p.m., Son Jaroco, a style of Mexican sun music from Veracruz, is at the heart of La Cafetera's appealing sound. They celebrate that tradition with a twist of Afro-Caribbean sounds, a bilingual fusion of poetic lyrics, and the exciting instrumentation of jarana, requinto, donkey jawbone, West African marimba, cajon, and a wooden platform called the tarima, used to dance zapateado. The July 8th event will feature an emphasis on expanding monarch butterfly habitats in Champaign County through a partnership with the Prairie Rivers Network. There's free exhibit space available to sustainably minded local businesses and organizations whose work relates to issues around the health of butterfly populations. If you're interested in having a booth there or want more information, you can contact Krannert Center's Lisa Lillig at 244-6298 or LILLIG at illinois.edu for more info. Research Park is a great place to see a concert. They have this really nice quadrangle that you can get out and be out with your neighbors and your friends. It's near the Natural Survey History Survey building at 1816 South Oak Street in Champaign. It's 6:52, and you are listening to WEFT. The views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Manager, Board of Directors, or WEFT Associates.
Okay. One more item, I think. Kathy Kelly is to speak at Channing Murray on Saturday, July 9th at 7 p.m., Kathy Kelly is a two-time Nobel Peace Prize nominee, humanitarian, and American peace activist who has spent a lifetime standing in solidarity with the victims of global violence and resisting the forces that perpetuate war and conflict around the world. She'll be speaking, as I mentioned, at the Channing Murray Foundation. As a co-founder and leader of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, Kathy is committed to the use of active nonviolence as a means of speaking truth to power, both military and economic. From being on the ground in Baghdad during shock and awe, to sending over 75 delegations to Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as emergency contingents to Gaza and Bahrain, Voices for Creative Nonviolence has been present with some of the people most forgotten and most affected by war in the Middle East. Join the sponsors, the Echo Justice Collaborative, and others for an evening of story, music, and inspiration from the front lines of global peacemaking.
Hear firsthand accounts from one of the world's most dedicated and courageous peacemakers. She certainly is. Kathy Kelly is a woman to behold. Learn about the growing movement of Afghan youth peace volunteers working to build an international, multi-generational movement seeking GEN, a green, equal, nonviolent world without war. Be moved by the stories of young people who are uniting to reject hatred, revenge, and killing, and who believe that nonviolent friendship can change Afghanistan and the world. There's going to be music that night by Holly Curia, a free will donation at the door to support the work of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. There's parking available at Channing Murray and at Davenport Hall, which is across the street after 5. This particular event is taking place on Saturday the 9th at 7 p.m. Mark your calendars. Channing Murray, Saturday the 9th of July at 7 p.m. This is really going to be a nice event for progressives to get together and hear a very woman who is very motivating and who has really made a difference in the lives of so many. Channing Murray is located at 1209 West Oregon Street in Urbana. You might know it better as the Red Herring Vegetarian Restaurant. or coffee shop. For more information, you can call Lan at 773-556-3417.
Mark your calendars for September 17th. WEFT will be hosting a street fest on Market Street with food booths, live music, and activities for all ages. This will take place on Saturday, September 17th, and will kick off our fall pledge drive.
Woohoo!
Yay!
In addition to being able to listen live at 90.1 FM and at www.org, WEF.org. WEF now has archived programs for each and every one of our shows. It's just something we've started doing recently. You can't have your music shows online forever because it's against the royalty thing, but we can archive them for 2 weeks and you can listen to them for 2 weeks at something called Radio Free America. That's where they're archived. You can access that from the front page of WEF.org. In addition, we are podcasting today. We are broadcasting CU Progressive News, a show called Literary Life by Amy Hassinger, Black Lives Matter by the local Black Lives Matter chapter, and Disability Beat, the show that you hear every Monday at 5:30. We'll be adding more and more public affairs program to our podcast lineup. Search for WEFT in iTunes, in SoundCloud, or whatever favorite podcatcher you use to find our WEFT podcasts.
CU Progressive News and Calendar has a production planning meeting, or does have production planning meetings, on Mondays and Thursdays. Our next meeting is Thursday, July 11th at 5 p.m. at WEFT, 113 North Market Street in Champaign.
Next week is July 4th on the Monday, and you're going to hear a replay of a documentary that I made about the death penalty 10-plus years ago. I went to Terre Haute, Indiana, when Timothy McVeigh was executed, and there was all kind of protests, both pro and anti-death penalty folks there, and I interviewed a lot of them and did a really nice hour-long documentary piece, and I've updated it so it has recent statistics in it, and you're going to hear that played next week on July 4th. The following week on July 11th, Aisha Connor Gates is going to be hosting. And she's a member of Black Lives Matter, so she's going to be hosting the CU Progressive News that week while I'm on vacation. I'm going to be riding my bike from Washington, D.C. to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Doesn't that sound great?
It'll be wonderful. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, our first stop after we leave Washington, on we're taking our car to Pittsburgh. We're getting on Amtrak with our bikes to Washington, D.C. We're going to watch the fireworks from the mall. And then we're going to make our first stop back in Harper's Ferry. So we're going to ride 50 miles that first night. There's a canal path for 180 miles, and then the next 200 and some miles are a bike path. So we're anxious to see that path. We've ridden the Katy Trail, which goes all the way from St. Charles, Missouri, almost to Kansas City. So we do like our bike paths. We like riding anyway, but the bike paths are particularly nice, the rail to trail, which we're getting one here. We've been reporting on the Kickapoo Trail, and I watched the development of that as it's being made, the first track of it is being made to St. Joe. So we're going to have a nice rail trail here. Saxon, thanks for being with me tonight and hosting the CU Progressive News.
My pleasure.
All right, we're going to turn it over to some music by Kevin Elliott as we transition to CU Radio Theater, and then later on with R&R Get Up and Dance with Just Fine.